turn the meeting over to Ellen.
My name is Ellen Cassidy, and I'm an enthusiastic member of Al-Anon. Let me tell you, your chairman for next year has set a high standard for the speaker picker upper. When she picked me up yesterday, she had on a black cap with a bill, she had on black gloves, she had on a black jacket, and blacky-looking pants, and little black shoes, and a name, my name printed on this board. She wanted to look like a chauffeur, and that's exactly what she looked like. And there was none of this, oh, I'm so glad to see you. No, there was, Ellen Cassidy, come with me. It was so cool. And of course, the minute we get in the car, she goes, you know, I'm supposed to look like a chauffeur. She was great. She was absolutely great. So I'm excited for you all for next year. You got two of the, just the, I've had more fun with those two, and so I know you will. Well, if you've been here all day, my heart goes out to you and your bottom. And I will try to keep this brief, but I've already given Terry, he just has to give me the sign when I've gone long enough. Because, you know, I always say, if God, that's what he's going to do. Well, thank you. It's been great. I always say, if God had only wanted me to talk an hour, he shouldn't have given me so much life. I'm not sure which part I'm supposed to leave out, you know. So I just start talking until somebody says that's enough, and then I quit. Usually. Not always. I introduce myself as an Al-Anon, and I always feel the need to explain that, which is not necessarily a good sign. Explaining things is how I got here. Because I always thought if I could get you to listen long enough, then you'd understand, and then you'd see that my way really was the better way, and we could do that, and we'd both be happy. It's just part of God's little joke in my life these days that now what there are little nests of people all around the country who have to sit and listen to me explain. And tonight is your night in the barrel. Al-Anon is not what I wanted to be when I grew up. I didn't know there was such a thing as Al-Anon. What I wanted to be when I grew up, from the time I drew my first breath, I believe, is I wanted to be somebody's wife and somebody's mother. And I was going to be the best wife he could ever want. And I was going to be the best mother those children could ever have had. I find it interesting in retrospect after 20-some-odd years in Al-Anon that I never wanted to be me. I wanted to be the best in somebody else's eyes, but it was not about being me. And, of course, that's not the way it turned out. I ended up being a lawyer, not without any degree, just with all the abilities, you know. A lawyer and a jury and a judge and an executioner, and none of us were happy. When I came to Al-Anon, I didn't want to be here, but I never really wanted to be where I was. I always wanted to be someplace else with somebody else doing something else. I was pretty sure when I got there, then things would be okay. And I'd been in here a while, I don't know, it's less than a year, and I decided that I really didn't want to be Al-Anon, whatever that was. What I really wanted to be was alcoholic. It looked to me, for lots of good reasons, like alcoholic women had a lot more fun than we did. I rest my case. And besides, apparently my husband preferred them. So I decided I'd be alcoholic. Now, I needed to be alcoholic that afternoon, so it pretty much left drinking out, you know. I couldn't, like, drink myself into it. And honestly, I was a little concerned about my drinking. Not that I drank to excess or got in any trouble or had any of that, but I really liked to drink. And I grew up in a family where everybody drank, and I knew that there were problems in our house. I was telling these people. I have a number of brothers. I have five of them still living, as a matter of fact. And when they start telling stories about each other, somewhere along in the story, one of them will say, oh, well, drinking was involved. Which is just redundant when it's with my brothers. It's just redundant. Of course drinking was involved. You were there, weren't you? Get by the way. Like we didn't know. Like this is an announcement, you know. I adore my brothers. I adore them. Well, of course I do. The kiss of death again. I love them. Okay. So I decided I really wanted to be alcoholic. And And I decided my solution was to that was the same as my solution always is in my diseasiness. I think if I change how it looks on the outside, it's going to change how it feels on the inside. Either I have to change the way you look or act or be or whatever, or I have to change the way the situation is in my life, and then I'll feel better. So all really I had to do was look alcoholic, and that would work fine. It just kind of loses something in the translation when you're not from gorgeous North Dallas, which is where I was going to meetings then, was gorgeous North Dallas, which is, honey, it's the, you know, it is a hot place. This is back in the early 80s, and so pretty much all I had to do was find and wear skin-tight jeans and stiletto heels. Well, I made a couple of discoveries in that experiment. Number one, I didn't like anything that controlled me like those pants did. And number two, Al-Anons are really doomed to sensible shoes. You know, we are built for speed and not for looks. If you love an alcoholic, you have got to be ready to go in an instant. You can't stand around and think about it. And you could kill yourself on those shoes. You could kill yourself. And then how's he going to survive? You know, you owe it to him to not wear those shoes. Well, the place I decided to do my little experiment, because God's rolling his eyes at me at that point, I'm pretty sure. The place I decided to do this little experiment is at the Crested Butte Mountain Conference with 600 of my closest friends. Crested Butte is a destination resort in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, obviously. It's a destination resort in that you have to be on your way there to get there because there's no road that goes through Crested Butte. A little like Eureka. Just come here and want to be here. And hope it's not foggy when it's ready for you to go, you know. That week that I chose, or it only took an afternoon, but I thought I was going to do it for a whole week. But that week at Crested Butte, I was with four people who had between them 125 years of Al-Anon. And this was 20 years ago. That was a lot of Al-Anon in one place. Elsa Chamberlain was there. Marcy White was there. Barbara Davis was there. Nancy Grinnan, who's a local of ours, and they were the ones who were there with all that Al-Anon. They were originals. They were people who came in when there was no Al-Anon. They came to AA, and AA welcomed them and let them come. Or I wouldn't be here today. Thank God for AA. I not only got to go to meetings with them and hear them share, but I got to go to meals with them. More importantly, I got to watch their interaction with their families and their families' interaction with them. And I finally knew what it was I wanted to be when I grew up, you know. When I came to my sixth Al-Anon meeting, I drove myself. I'd been escorted to the first six. I looked like I couldn't be counted on to get there myself, and that was pretty much the truth. My seventh one, I drove myself. And you know what that's like when someone else has taken you all this time and now you got to take yourself? It's like you'd never been there, you know. It's like, I don't know which way to go. And this group had met upstairs, and you had to climb all these stairs to get up there, and there was a sign at the top of the stairs just next to the door that said, only 12 more steps to go. And I thought, what is that? And I'm looking around, you know, like, where are the rest of the steps? And this, of course, you know, I don't know what it's like in your area. In my area, we meet where the AAs meet. And generally, Al-Anon meetings are at the same time the AA meetings are. Well, at this meeting, as in most meetings, there was an AA greeter at the door. And for some reason, AA finds it necessary to put their sickest people at the door. I don't know why. And this one stuck out his hand, you know, and he was like, hi, welcome to AA. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm not here for AA. I'm really here for Al-Anon. And he goes, oh. Oh, Al-Anon. Oh. And he says, you know, you got to go through the big room where the really sick people are. They don't know us well, you know. To the little room in the back where the tables don't exactly match because we've given them our hand-me-down tables, and they're all blue-haired and purse-lipped, and those are the Al-Anons. Oh, yeah. These are the people I'm going to spend the rest of my life with, you know. Oh, yeah. And they did look a little purse-haired. I say that often. Purse-lipped and blue-haired to me when I got there. But what happened was I'd landed in a nest of winners, and I didn't know that. You know, they tell you you should stick with the winners, but they don't. Usually winners don't have name tags on that say, hi, I'm a winner, stick with me. They do at situations like today. The winners have had name tags on. In my opinion, the winners are the people who don't go to just one meeting a week because they have to. They don't come to Al-Anon to survive. They come to Al-Anon because they want everything this program has to offer. They want to do more than just survive. They want to live. And there's a big difference between being a survivor and being a liver. Now, you have to survive to be a liver, which I think is being a liver is a cool thing when you're consumed with alcoholism. But anyway, healthy livers at that. Ha, ha, ha. I landed in a nest of winners. I landed in a nest of folks. See, this is going to happen. I kind of thought it wasn't, but here it goes. The very first meeting I went into that I got to was an Al-Anon Big Book study. The Al-Anons were reading the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they weren't reading it looking at for the alcoholic story. They were reading it to find themselves on the pages of the Big Book. I got to tell you, I had to read it like 42 times before I quit turning corners back from my mother and highlighting parts for him. But on about the 42nd time through there, I went, oh my God, that's me they're talking about. I have the same thinking. I have the same compulsions. My physical addiction is different. But alcohol in my way of thinking is a personality, it isn't a principle. The other stuff is really basic to human beings, you know, is you got to think and you got to act. Hello? And it's me. I'm on the pages of that book. This is one of my soapboxes, and I guess you're going to hear it. I have these big conversations with myself before I start talking, and I say, we're not talking about that tonight, okay? We're not, okay? And I go, okay, we're not. And then I get up here and my mouth goes, blah, 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 blah. Not God's in charge, so I can't, you know, what can I tell you? It's just, this is a deal. It's not my deal. Okay. I think that it is damn near impossible to work our traditions or to have a program if you don't read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Al-Anon has everything we've written about the program is secondhand information. It says in our tradition that we are to practice the 12 steps of AA ourselves, and how we think we can do that without reading the instructions is only an Al-Anon would think they could do that. I don't need the instructions, thank you. I can figure it out myself. I'm a smart person. I can do this. That's close enough for me. I can figure out the rest. And that's what we do, you know. I'm sure most of you know, because you tend to be a very informed group, that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is not conference-approved literature in Al-Anon. And I've had several discussions with Virginia Beach and New York, when it was New York, about that, because it still tends to stump me. Arbutus says that we don't have to approve anything, that our conference doesn't have to approve literature because the AAs have already approved it, and that the AAs would be insulted if we had to reapprove what they already approved. I don't know how we can do our fifth tradition. I don't know how we can give understanding and comfort to families of alcoholics if we don't understand the disease. I don't know how we can be supportive to the alcoholics in our lives without understanding the disease, and it's in that book. I was raised on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a Big Book Al-Anon. I am so grateful that the AAs didn't say, if you don't drink like I drink, you can't have this book. And that's not what they said. They said they wanted it to be for everybody, and that's what they've done with it. The first group I went to, I really thought that the first step of the program was get in the car, because that's what they used to say to me. They'd say, "We're going to the Brazos Riverside Conference. Get in the car." So and so is doing the steps across town at Bruton Terrace or whatever. Get in the car. They didn't say, do you want to? Do you have anything else going on? They said, get in the car. They said, we know you have two little kids and a drinking maniac at home. Get in the car. I got in the car. Well, I talked about this earlier today. When I got to Al-Anon, I didn't have very many opinions of my own. Actually, I don't believe I had any. I tended to wait to see what your opinions were. And then I either agreed with you if I wanted to make you happy, or I argued with you if I wanted to tick you off. But I couldn't really tell you what my own opinions were. Today I have fairly strong opinions, as you can tell, which is neither good nor bad. It's just different. And that's all I'm promised in this program, is that my life is going to be different. You know, and it's different today. One of the things I have very strong opinions about are people being called Al-Anon. If you want to watch the hair on my neck stand up, let me be there when the new drunk comes in the room and somebody says, oh, look, there's John, the new drunk, and there's his little Al-Anon wife twitching in behind him. And there she comes with the twitch. She's not an Al-Anon. They're calling her an Al-Anon because she's with John. That doesn't make her an Al-Anon. She's an alligator. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it, because this planet reeks of people who could use Al-Anon. The statistics, which are very important if you're an explainer, statistics are, for every alcoholic, there are 10 to 42 people directly affected. 10 to 42. Who do you think that leaves on the planet? I'm thinking no one. You know, I'm thinking that's pretty much all of us is what I'm thinking. And I got way more than my share, you know. 10 to 42 people. Al-Anon ought to be 10 to 42 times bigger than AA. Ain't a happening thing. This will be, you know, this is a nice, this is a big size meeting for Al-Anons. In just about any area of the country, this is a big size meeting. It is hard to come and ask for help when there's nothing the matter with you. And there's nothing the matter with us when we get here. It's very obvious where the problem is, and if he'd straighten up, I wouldn't have to live like this. Oh, any idiot could see that. My mother was telling me that for years, you know. I was darn near perfect, and he was a wreck. Al-Anon's a harder place to stay when you get here. You know, I'm pretty sure, I don't know because I've never been a new drunk, but I'm pretty sure what happens on the other side is when a new drunk shows up and he says, this stuff is killing me, they say, you know what, we're going to show you a way to live so you don't have to ever drink again. And we're going to help you stay out of slippery places. And that's what they do, pretty much. They're on call 24 hours a day, help them stay out of slippery places. You come to an Al-Anon meeting and you tell us a time or two about what he's doing now, and we'll listen a time or two. We aren't going to listen any more than that, but we'll listen a time or two to it. And then we say, okay, go home and get in bed with him. You know, you want to know where one of the slipperiest places in my life is in my bed. And I got to get in there with him. The AAs don't send him home to sleep with the bottle just to test you and see how you are, you know, see if you're getting better with that or not. I got to get in bed with it. I got to fix it breakfast in the morning, you know. It is a hard place to stay. And most of us, and I'll tell you me, I didn't come here looking for recovery. I came here looking for relief. I came here looking to feel better because I felt awful and I wanted to feel better. I came looking for power and walked into a room full of folks who said they didn't have any. What a disappointment, you know. Are we all like defective or something, you know? Are we banding together to make power between us and then we'll go out en masse and try to heal them one at a time? You know, what are we doing? It was very confusing to me. And you know, we really do, and I know there are some alcoholics in the room, and if you've been to an Al-Anon meeting, yay for you, and if you haven't, you have now. But we talk in our meetings, at every meeting, at least where I go, that we're going to keep the focus on us and not on the alcoholic. Keep the focus on us and not on the alcoholic. Oh, right, on the focus on us and not on the alcoholic. So we really tend to not talk about alcoholics in the room. Although I got to tell you, when Addison, when this little group first formed, there's a couple of us in there who just laugh our fannies off on a regular basis. By the way, it happened during the day today, and I didn't say anything, and I want to say it now. There's a lot of laughter, which is, you know, I always think God's heard us cry, and he's so glad to hear us laugh. But you know what? You can't laugh about something that hadn't been healed. And you may hear people, you might have heard them today, and you might hear them tonight laughing about something that still hurts. It's just a place that's not healed. Keep coming back. Keep bringing your sore places with you, and you too will find healing here. But don't take it personally if we're laughing at stuff. We're not laughing at you, really. You're not that funny. And your issue is not that different, whatever your issue is, you know. We're not that different. Anyway, that's what happened after a meeting, after we'd been there a couple of weeks, and these AAs on the other side, who had invited us to come, they said, we'll be a stronger AA group if we have Al-Anons with us. And we want you to start a meeting next to us, and we did, and we laughed our fannies off, and one night the door blew open, you know, and there were these three or four AAs standing on the other side, and one of them had his hands on his hip, and he said, what are y'all laughing at? They thought we were laughing at them, man. You know, it was great. Because we really did. One of us who was most bold, still is, she said, you're not that funny. She said that to him, and it was great. But anyway, whatever I was saying was terribly important. It's gone now. The train left the station. So, Al-Anon's, it's hard to get here, it's harder to stay. Because we come looking for power. And what will happen in our meetings sometimes is, you know, we really do keep the focus on us most of the time. But occasionally somebody feels the need to tell an old war story, you know. They feel the need to tell them about what it used to be like instead of what they used to be like. You know, those are our instructions. We're supposed to share what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like today, not what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today. It hadn't changed a whole lot. What's changed is me. That's what I have to share with you. But so this one will say something like, oh, she'll start talking about the last time old Harry came home drunk and passed out, and she got some fingernail polish and poured it in one of his body orifices somewhere, you know, and old Harry woke up the next morning and looked down and went, oh, my God, and he's been sober ever since, you know. And you watch the little newcomer in the room go, oh. And you may not see her or him again for a while, if ever. Because the truth is, they got what they came for, you know, looking for one more thing that might work. And listen, before you try that, it doesn't work, really. It doesn't. It's like trying to teach a pig to sing. It wastes your time and annoys the pig, you know. We don't recommend it, really. But she got what she came for, she got a suggestion, something she hadn't tried, one more thing she could do to get him to act, to get her life like she wants her life. The dividing line in Al-Anon is the third step. I know it says in the AA 12 and 12 that it's six is what separates the men from the boys or the sheep from the lamb or something. I don't know, but for us, it's step three. Because what you hear in Al-Anon is if you do the third step, if you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him, your life is going to change. And our tendency is to go, oh, wait, just a minute. There's been a little miscommunication here, apparently, because it's really, my life is not that bad. Really, all I'm trying to do, I just want his life to get fixed, and then we'll be fine. And we don't want our lives to change. We really don't. I'll tell the story again. Many of you have heard it. Here you go. You're going to hear it again. We're like folks in a lake of liquid manure up to about here. It's not particularly pleasant, but it's familiar. It's been there a long time, and it's ours, and it's warm, and we know how it got there. And people come by in a boat, and they say, whoa, we know what that's like where you are, and you don't have to live that way anymore. We can show you the way out of there. We can show you the way to a power that'll solve your problem. And we go, oh, no, 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 no. We sing the Al-Anon chorus, it's not that bad. Say, really, really, my life's not that bad. All I really need you to do is keep that guy over there from making waves. Lesson number two, the only thing that guy can kick up is my stuff. You know, he's not adding anything to the pile. He's just kicking up my stuff is all he's doing over there. But that's, you know, that's how I feel about change. Al-Anon's, we're not a program for people who need it. We're not a program for people who want it. People come, some of them are attracted by the laughter, some of them are repulsed by the laughter because alcoholism is not funny. It's a deadly disease. And if you're the one in the family stone cold sober, we tend to think we have to carry that responsibility. Someone has got to and take this seriously. And we are as serious as death about it. We are really only a program for people who are willing to work at it because it requires effort. Sometimes slight, sometimes more than slight, but it's effort. Continuous effort is what my Al-Anon program requires. I'm not an Al-Anon because of the people in my life, although they are what got me here. What got me here was the first part of the first step, that I was powerless over alcohol. What has kept me here is the second part of the first step, which is my own powerlessness. That much as I want to, much as I need to, I cannot change my life or theirs. I had to come to a place, even in Al-Anon, where I understood the difference between powerless and helpless. It was not hard for me to admit powerlessness. It was fairly obvious when I got here. But after several years in Al-Anon, I got to the place where I could admit helplessness. which is a tough thing to admit, that I couldn't even change myself. I hear people say that, you know, on a regular basis, I'm going to work to change myself. I can't change myself. I can't even save my own life. I can't do it. I don't have the power. But I have step two. And I couldn't do step one until I knew about two. Two says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Doesn't say it would. No guarantees here. All I'm here to do is believe in the possibilities, you know, that it is possible that I could be restored. I think of step one as the end of all possibility. I've done everything. And that's often where I am at step one. I've done everything I can think of. I've done everything I can think of. I am finally out of plans. And I'm at step one. And when I'm willing to get myself to let myself slide into step two, all the possibilities that I dreamed of and more is available. Because there's a power greater than me that wants more for me than even I want for me. I'm an Al-Anon. Because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it. Because I am convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. Do you know who uses the insurance first in an alcoholic home? The non-alcoholic. We develop a number of stress-related diseases. I am convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. You watch AAs go to meetings. They go to meetings like their life depends on it. I watch people go to meetings like they have a choice. I don't have a choice. I don't want a choice. I go to meetings because my life depends on it. Not just the quality of my life, but I believe the quantity of my life. And I have a committed meeting. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting that I go to every week like a doctor's appointment. If you want to find me, you come Monday night at 6:15 to the Addison Al-Anon family group, and that's where I'll be. I might be late, but I'll be there. I have to deliver my little grandchildren home, and sometimes I just don't make it on time, but I'm there. And when I walk in that room, they go, oh, like I've watched you all do all day long today. They go, oh, Alan, there you are. Sometimes they just wave at me across the room if I'm late. Or somebody will pat the seat beside him for me to come sit next to him. If I want to. I don't have to just because they saved me a seat. But I can if I want to. It's a place where I belong. Not because they've accepted me, but because I've done my part. I've done the service work that makes me a part. I've chaired meetings. I've been the literature person. I've been the everything. Some of it I liked. A lot of it I didn't like. But I didn't know till I tried. That's what I tell my little kids. You won't know if you don't try. Just try. See what works for you and see what doesn't work for you. You know, one of the things that happens is a couple of you, I think two of you for your people next year, or maybe not. I'm making stuff up again. Never mind. Anyway, one time I was asked to come to our area assembly and speak to the area assembly. I've never been to an area assembly. And I won't go again unless for some reason God sees necessary to make me go. But I watched them a little bit of that day with an all-day-long Al-Anon business meeting. Ah! Deliver me! I thought, oh, my God! Oh! Just shoot me! Don't make me go back to that! Oh! They were arguing about the... They were discussing these little bitty tiny thing, and I'm thinking, oh my God. And I called my sponsor when I got home and I said, I'm a terrible Al-Anon. I said, that just looked horrifying to me. And I said, I guess that means I have to do it, huh? She said, no way. They don't want people like you doing that. She said that the first time she'd gone to an area assembly, or the first time they had an area assembly, she said it almost turned me off Al-Anon forever. I'm so grateful that there are people who can go to that and be fed by that and keep that structure alive and functioning. Because we wouldn't be here without them. But it isn't my service work to do. It is not my service work to do. This is my service work to do. A lot of people say, I don't know how you get behind that microphone and talk. I'll talk with one, without one. It really doesn't matter to me, you know. I think Al-Anon speaker is like redundant anyway, you know. it is not, this is, you know, what I end up with, you'll know what I end up with at the end of this, but I end up fed by you by the time this is over. This is mine to do. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor who knows everything there is to know about me, and I call her. I actually talk to her, and then, even more important, I listen to her. Listen to what she has to say to me. Usually, like I called her yesterday from the airport, I always call her somewhere en route when I'm traveling, and it's a great time for us to talk, and she's done a lot of traveling for Al-Anon, too, and so she'll say, let me listen to the airport, see if she, that's a little game, see if we can identify what airport are we in. Yesterday, she thought I was watching TV. No, ma'am. Portland. A. I'm in the A terminal. Oh, Portland, A terminal. Got it. Like she really knows, but anyway. A lot of times her advice to me is, now have you washed your undies out? Make me proud. Okay, I'm on my way. But the thing is, I can't make her not proud, you know. I know that. I'm an Al-Anon. Not because of anybody but me. Because that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want the freedom that's offered me in step 3. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Who is it that ties me in knots? Not him, not them, it's me. I want the freedom to be me, and I can't find it any place else but here. When I was 17, Mama diagnosed me, and she sent me someplace where she thought I'd be safe. Mama diagnosed me as boy crazy. And the place, she didn't realize I was a very discerning boy crazy girl. You know, I only picked the craziest boys. She sent me to Lubbock, Texas, because she thought I'd be safe. And it turns out the very first Al-Anon meeting in the entire state of Texas was in Lubbock. Lubbock is in what you call your Bible Belt. It's a dry area. Dry. They say dry. And they mean dry. In every form there possibly is. It rains one day a year. And you don't want to be there the day it rains. They can't drive in the rain. They have to park the cars. The streets don't have any drainage on them. The streets fill up with water, you know, and everything. It's a dry place. And if you want to watch alcoholics drink, tell them they can't, you know. So there's little areas of Lubbock where you can just go find them. It's like shooting ducks in a barrel, you know. You just get them. They're out there, you know, on the Tahoka Highway. If you ever get there, that's where you go. Tahoka Highway, that's where they are. Well, it took me to 6 months to find him. Of course, I was always looking for him. Even if I had a him, I was looking for him. And it took me 6 months, but I found him. He was 60 pounds overweight and married to somebody else and had 2 kids, but none of that seemed insurmountable to me. I really have never liked the easy ones. You know, the ones who go, oh, you're really cute. Could I have a date? I go like, get away from me! Creep! I want those ones you have to fight for, you know? The ones you have to do battle for. Like, you have to bleed for them, you know? You have to, like, change your whole life for them. And then you get them, and you have your prize. Oh, lucky, lucky you. And it took me a year, but at the end of the year, we had shed the wife, the 2 kids, and the 60 pounds, and I had my prize. Oh, lucky, lucky me. We'd been married 6 months when he hit me the first time. He was drunk when he hit me. He was drunk every time he hit me. I did not grow up in a family where adults hit each other, so the reaction I had to that was not anything anybody taught me. I came up with it all by myself. In the same place I come up with all my solutions, right between my little ears. I've decided the problems in my life are not the problems. The problems in my life are the solutions I come up for what I perceive as problems. I remember it like it was yesterday. I knew when he hit me it wasn't appropriate. And I thought, I must find a way to let him know this is not appropriate. How shall I react? And I stood and I thought about it. And then I came up with my best solution. And my best solution was to double dog dare him to do it again. In retrospect, I look at that and I think, whoa, little touch of insanity right there from the get-go, you know. But it seemed like a really good idea at the time, which is the problem with most of my solutions. They seem like a really good idea at the time. For some length of time, I continued to volunteer for that abuse by double dog daring him to do it again. Of course, it didn't take any more insanity on his part to hit me the second time than it did the first time. If you've been physically abused, I do not have to explain this to you. If you've not been, I cannot explain it to you. Let me just tell you what at somewhere in the process, I went from being the volunteer for that abuse to being a victim. I don't know when it happened. I know today how it happened. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was, you deserve that. Every time he hit me and I believed him when he said, if you hadn't done what I did, I wouldn't have to do what I did. Every time he hit me and I got up the next morning and I looked in the mirror at a swollen nose or a black eye or a cut lip and I said to myself, it's not that bad. I'll just stay in the house another day or another 2 days and nobody will notice. Every time I did that, a piece of me left. And then another piece and then another piece and then another piece until 9 years later there was no one left in here who could stand up and say, you can't treat me like that. I'm a precious child of God. And that's how long I stayed. I stayed married for 9.5 years. Apparently, I will stay in those situations because I've done it repeatedly until my life is threatened. And what happened was he held me repeatedly under a cabin cruiser in 20 feet of water. And when I told my first sponsor about that physical abuse, she said, honey, that's not physical abuse, that's attempted murder. But I have a disease called it's not that bad. And that's what I said was it's not that bad. Now, the reason I left him was because somebody came along who said, you don't have to live like that. Wasn't the first person that said that. But he added the magic words, and I love you. What? You know, when I came to Al-Anon, there was a sign on my desk at work that said, Wonder Woman works here. And I always tell those alcoholics, if your business is failing, I'll tell you why. You don't have an alligator working for you. You need an alligator in your office. We will come early and stay late. We'll work through lunch. We'll take it home for the weekend. We'll pick up your cleaning. We will lie, we will cheat, we will steal, but we will make you look good. We will. And we can do 25 things at a time, just about, you know. Every once in a while, even in recovery, I got to see if I can get all those things going at the same time again. I can, really. It's one of my greatest talents. Because I can do all that stuff at one time. What I did at my job was I did enough stuff that what I did was create an Ellen-sized hole there so that there wasn't any way they could do without me. I was critical to their survival. I had to be there. They needed me. And I had reached a place where I had to be needed. It had to be critical. It was the only way I felt even alive. And when I left there, it took 4 people to replace me. And I don't think they're doing a very good job either. Anyway, it looked like I had it all together. You know, that's one of the other things that's real tricky about us. We look like we have it all together, you know. We don't even know what it is, but we've got it together. The fact of the matter is, my sponsor used to tell me that I had to chase my fears to their base to find out what the underlying fear was, and she assured me there was always an underlying fear. What she didn't tell me when I started was it's always the same fear. But once I started chasing one and got to its base, I have found that it's the baseline fear for all my other fears. Of course, when I got here, I wasn't afraid. I told you that today. There really wasn't anything to be afraid of. I could handle anything came along. It turns out I'm very afraid. I finally reached a point where I called her up one time and I said, I don't know what's going on. I just don't know, but I feel like I'm falling apart. I can't tell what's going on. And she said, well, she would say things to me like, just start talking. You don't have to know, just start talking. And I needed ears to hear me and I'd start talking and she'd say, and finally I got to where I could tell her that time that I was afraid he was going to leave me. Whoa, that's it. There you go. That's the fear. You're afraid he's going to leave you. She said, I went, oh yes, that's it. I'm afraid. I'm afraid he's going to leave me. And she said, oh, well, what would happen if he left you? You mean there's something else? Yes, there's something else. What would happen if he left you? Well, let's see. I don't know. Talk, 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 talk. If he leaves me, then, oh, my gosh, then I'm by myself. Ah, that's the thing. That's what I'm afraid of. I have a fear of abandonment. You know, that was back in the early 80s when they go, and she'd say, ah, that's a really big deal, fear of abandonment. Yeah, that gets a lot of people in trouble, you know, fear of abandonment, wow. She says, so you're afraid that he will leave you and you'll be by yourself. She said, what will happen then if you're by yourself?
More. I have to go farther.
I thought I was doing so good, you know, and she always goes, good, now there's more. Well, if he leaves me by myself, I'm going to be here all alone. And if I'm here all alone, the fear is I can't take care of myself. I'm not enough for me. Now, that's a little kid fear. That's the way little kids feel. I've got to have a parent here. I've got to have somebody take care of me because I can't take care of myself. Sometimes it's reinforced. It was reinforced for me as a little kid, which was, you can't take care of yourself. Someone's got to be here to take care of you. You can't take care of yourself. Okay, right. I can't take care of myself. But I buy them and I keep it. You know, we make decisions as little children with little children's perception, and then we live from those decisions. And those of us who have gotten stuck in the disease of alcoholism never have a chance to change our minds. We live from those little kid decisions most of our lives, which is why we have the process of the steps, why we have the fourth step, so you can get back and find those decisions. I could go back and find the decisions I made as a little kid, which are now old ideas. You know, they were survival mechanisms when I was little. They are old ideas now, and they're keeping me from living my life. So the truth of the matter is, I needed him to be with me, because if he wasn't going to be with me, I would die. And his being with me became a matter of life and death. I looked like Wonder Woman, and the fact is I was afraid for my life. And when somebody said, I love you, to me, what I heard was, I will take care of you. I will take care of you. Well, it took me another year, but I'm like the Mounties. I always get my man. And I had him. Another trophy! Oh, look at me. And you would love this guy. I don't even know if he's still alive. I suspect he is, or I'd know that he wasn't. But you would have loved him. I mean, after the first one, I knew how I'd screwed up. I knew what the problem was, so I rectified that with the second one. This one was the right height, the right age, right family, right coloring, right job, right education, right amount of money, everything. It was right. Well, there was one teeny tiny little flaw. He didn't come home nights. But I'm thinking, you know, a couple of home-cooked meals and a little, you know, and I got him. It's the way I mark my territory. Mm-hmm. Used to be a lot more effective before menopause. You know? Now I just pretty much don't care. You know? Who cares? Anyway, big deal back then. And I'm thinking it's working, you know, because I got him and stuff is trucking along. We're moving along. He's coming home nights. All right, I'm doing it right. Because he's behaving the way I want him to behave. Well, if you're married to a bar drinker, let me tell you a little truth. They drink in the bars, and that means they don't come home some nights. They just don't come home. And the night came when he didn't come home, and I decided, of course, it was about me, that I'd gained 2 pounds, and he didn't love me anymore, and that's why he wasn't coming home. And then I decided I told him the wrong thing was for dinner. I should have told him something else. Everybody knows he likes pork chops. From now on, I'm always saying pork chops, and then he'll come home. And then I decided I needed to go sit on the sofa and wait for him. Now, if you're in training for Al-Anon, you must go through graduate waiting. And the way that you know you're in graduate waiting is if when you are waiting, you can do nothing else. You can't talk on the phone, you can't read a book, you can't watch TV, you can't cook a meal. The kids would come up to me and they'd go, Mom, and I'd go, can't talk to you, I'm waiting. And that's because while you're waiting, you're listening. You're listening for the sound of those tires. There are 40 bazillion tires on the planet, don't care about them. I know the sound of those tires. And I have a physical reaction to those tires. When I hear them, I go, he's home. It's all going to be okay. He's home. And I might throw myself into bed and act like I've been asleep all night so he won't know I've been up there being frantic. Or I might jump on him like, you know, like at the door when he comes in and like my mouth is attached to the doorknob. You know, they say, turn the doorknob and she goes, rah, 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 rah. You know. But that's what I do. And of course, the first night that happened that he didn't come home, my head does what my, I thought we weren't going to tell this story either, but here we are. In my head, I will make up stories. If I don't believe what's going on, if I don't like what's going on, if I can't trust what's going on, my head makes up stories and I live in my stories. And my stories will have dialogue for both of us. And I expect you to say your dialogue. Now, if I have to tell you what it is that you're supposed to say, it doesn't mean anything. You have to come up with the words on your own, and I'm very disappointed when you don't. And I'll find a way to let you know, but I'm very disappointed. And I made up this story in my head that somehow, some way, he'd gotten, his car was out in the country, I don't know why, but he was out in the country, and all of a sudden the car like blew up all by itself, you know, and there wasn't anybody there, and it blew his little body into this ditch by the side of the road, and he's bleeding, you know, and body parts are hanging off, you know, and he's not quite dead, and with his dying breath, he's calling me, and he's saying, Ellen, Ellen, I love you. And, you know, and now wild animals are coming and tearing off the body parts and strewing them in the forest, and it'll be 7 years before we can identify the body. Well, I called that love. I realized after I'd been in Al-Anon not too very long that that's actually what we would call obsession. Obsession is not obsession until in your mind somebody dies, you know. And I can take it in a heartbeat till somebody dies, you know, in my head. You know what obsession is? Obsession is all-out warfare on powerlessness. The more powerless I feel, the more apt I am to be obsessed. I may be obsessed about the thing I'm powerless over, and I might pick something else. I'm an equal opportunity obsessor. I can obsess about the children, my weight, exercise, my food, my job, his job, his weight. You name it. If I got a name for it, I can obsess about it. And the tendency of that obsession is to keep me, to give me the idea that I got some power someplace, you know, and I don't have it. Well, of course, he came home. I'm here to tell you that 99 times out of 100, they come home. Might be that day or the next week or 3 years later, but they come home. And I met him at the door like a three-year-old that's been crying all afternoon, and you've said, stop it. You know, I was at the place, you know, big swollen eyes and snot slinging. And I think about that, and I think, no wonder he drank. You know, if that's waiting for me at home, I'll just have another. And I ask him the second stupidest question we ever asked. The stupidest, of course, is, have you been drinking? The second stupidest is, where have you been? Because the truth of the matter is, the only answer that was going to be satisfactory for me was in a ditch bleeding. That was really the only one that I could find some peace with. Anything else was either going to hurt my feelings or make me mad. And he said to me, Jesus God, you knew where I was. And you know, the truth of the matter is, I knew where he was. He only went three places. He was either at home, at work, or in the trap room drinking. But I had the ability to hold opposing thoughts in my head, and they never touch. And the two thoughts I had in my head that day were, number one, he loves me more than anything in the world, and number two, he's in the trap room drinking. But if number one is true, how can number two be true? It can't be. And my life hung on, he loves me more than anything in the world. In my diseasiness, I would rather wish him dead than face the reality of the situation. And he said to me, you have certainly worked yourself up into a state, little missy. Sometimes I think you're about as crazy as your mother. The big one, Elizabeth. Oh, you know. Which, of course, was my worst fear, you know, that I was as crazy as my mother. And I said to him, I'm sorry. Now, what's the matter with this picture? Hello? He's 3 hours late and drunk, and I'm the one standing there apologizing at the door. I have an addiction to mind-altering men. And actually, it's not limited to men. Pretty much anybody who wants my brain, apparently I'll let them play with it, you know, if they want to. Even if they don't want to, I like hand it to them, you know, like, here, mess with my head a while. They're the ones who say to you, he used to say to me, 5 o'clock, why in the world would I ever tell you I was coming home at 5? I never come home at 5. I just think you make this stuff up. And that's where the twitch comes from, you know. I could have sworn he said 5 o'clock. I really could have sworn he said, I must be making it up. Jeez, I'm as crazy as my mother. I mean, that's what happens to you. So, lady calls me up. Blah, blah, blah. Lady says, she's new in Al-Anon, and we're deadly when we're new. You know, she called me at work, and I did this whole thing. Oh, apparently I'm going to tell this one, too. I'm sorry, you're going to have to really make that sign in a minute. Primary Al-Anon illusion is, when you're okay, then I'll be okay. And I will do everything in my power to make you okay. I will lie, I will cheat, I will steal. I will go places I don't want to go with people I don't want to be with. I'll stay up when I'm tired or go to bed when I'm not. I'll eat when I'm not hungry and won't eat when I am. And I'll sit up all night with your sick mother in the hospital when I don't like your mother and I don't like the hospital. But by God, I'll do it. It looks very loving and kind on the outside. It's the most self-centered behavior on the inside. I don't do it because I care. I do it because I need you to be a certain way for me. I need a certain response from you to make me okay. And if I don't get that from you, I will do it harder. Or I'll do it on Tuesdays, or I'll only serve you pork chops, or I'll take my clothes off, or whatever. That used to be more effective before menopause, too. But I will do whatever I have to get that response from you. We have a deal in the group where I go, where we have Kleenex boxes on the table. But when people start crying, we don't shove them at them. We don't give. It's a very subtle way of saying to somebody, your tears must be bothering you because they're bothering me. Dry them up. It may be the most loving thing we do for each other in Al-Anon is to attend each other's pain. We sit with somebody when they hurt. When somebody starts crying in our group, we don't pat them on the back and tell them everything's going to be okay. Because you know what? Everything sucks some days. That's not where the transformation has come. But we will sit next to them when they hurt. And we will listen to them and we'll share ourselves with them. But if you want to watch an alligator go crazy, start crying around one of them. Holy God, Kleenex come from everywhere, you know. Yes. If there are any of you double winners in the room, I'm going to tell you that's the way we single you out at our meeting. We can tell who's a double winner because somebody will start crying, Lord, the Kleenex are coming from all over the room, out of purses, off the table, you know. Ooh, drive those tears, drive those tears. Drive those tears. Ah, there's one we need to work on. Ooh, all the alarms have gone off. Well, this lady called and told me this thing, and all my alarms went off, and I gave myself away as probably living in active alcoholism, and she was new, and we're deadly when we're new. We got a lot of answers. We don't know what the questions are, but we got a lot of answers, and we do the Al-Anon waltz. You know, we do 1, 2, 12, 1, 2, 12, 1, 2, 12. I know what the problem is. I got the answer. Let me tell you about it. All those other steps in between. Filler. You know, I got it. Don't need to do it. She was perfect for me, and she was the one that took me to those first six meetings and landed me in the nest of winners. And I went to Al-Anon like a dying person because I was a dying person at that point. After a while, we started going through a difficult time in our home, and that's the rule in alcoholic homes is a difficult time. That's what happens. It doesn't get better. It gets worse. Untreated alcoholism gets worse. And I discovered my husband was having an affair. My sponsor said it doesn't have anything to do with you. See, the insanity was, I knew he did drugs. I knew he gambled. I knew he drank. I knew he hung out in the bar. I knew he was only coming home like 8 nights a month. But I always thought he was faithful. Hello, La La Land. I have an address there. And I found out he was having an affair. She said, it has nothing to do with you. She said he has a God-sized hole, and he's throwing everything in the hole he can find. He's throwing drugs and alcohol and gambling, and now he's going to try other women. But she said he can't fill up the hole. It's not his to fill up. It's God's hole. It has nothing to do with whether he loves you or doesn't love you. What that had to do with was it made me deal with the truth of how I got to Al-Anon. I told you I was here because of my husband's unacceptable behavior. The truth was I was here because of my own unacceptable behavior. I was married to the man of my dreams, and I was having an affair. And it wasn't my first. Wasn't my last either, but it was real close to the last one. You got to go for progress, not perfection, you know. That's another thing that menopause pretty much took care of me, you know. Who cares? Anyway, program helped a lot. And I had to deal with the truth of that. You know, Al-Anon has allowed me to close up a lot of those little circles in my life where I've gotten to do the both sides of a lot of things. And that incident put me on the side of understanding what it was like on the other side of a spouse having an affair. And I think that's the moment I made the decision to stay here for me and not for anybody else. Shortly thereafter, we separated. The rule in alcoholic homes is separation and divorce. He came home after a month, and he'd been sober about 2 weeks and it was New Year's Eve, and New Year's Eve with a newly sober guy is boring. And on my way to bed, I touched a place in my chest where there'd been some burning for some time. I should have gone to the doctor for my checkup in September, but I couldn't go because I was so focused on his behavior. And this was the end of December, and what I found was a lump. I was too young for breast cancer. There's no history of breast cancer in my family. I did some talking around about it. The upshot of it is that cancer is prevalent in alcoholic homes. There were studies even then, 20 years ago, that said that cancer was a stress-related disease. There was nobody who could tell me why I had cancer. It became mine to diagnose, just as alcoholism is for an alcoholic to diagnose. And I did the steps. You know, I'm sure there are people who can live without written directions. I'm not one of them. The only thing that makes sense in my life is to go through the steps. And I went through the steps in a closed step study. And I did my inventory on the time when the tumor was growing. What my decision was that mine was a stress-caused cancer. Living in active alcoholism is about the most stressful thing I've ever known. And I don't I don't want, if there's anything worse, I don't want it, thank you. That was enough for me. The prognosis in the hospital was that in 5 years, if there were 100 women in the room with the same prognosis as I had, in 5 years, 60 would be left and 40 of them would be gone. I had a little better than a 50-50 shot of making it another 5 years, much less 20 years, but a 50-50 shot. I thought for a long time that the reason I've lived is because I did such a good job of the steps. Yeah, I don't think that anymore. That's okay, Elle. If that's what you need to think, go for it, babe, but I don't think that's the truth. I must be here because I'm still being of service. That must be the reason I'm still here. In my Al-Anon group of about 30 women, there are five of us who have had breast cancer. It's a lot of us in one room. But if you look around, you'll find there you have the same numbers in your group. Or colon cancer or lung cancer, which we also have in young women in our groups. I made the decision for the first time that my life was more valuable. And I told him if he couldn't stay sober, he couldn't stay there. And he couldn't stay sober. And I'd said that 1,000 times, but this time I knew my life depended on it. And he ended up moving out. Now, if he told you why he moved out, he would have said it was because of that idiot daughter of mine. I had a beige and navy blue son who was disappearing. He got quieter and quieter. He slept more during the day and less at night. And he disappeared into his room and into TVs and into video games. I used to tell him that if he could just find a job as a grown-up that he could do with his thumbs, he could make a fortune, because that's all he did. La, 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 la. And I had a hot pink, neon orange daughter who was out there. She wasn't on the edge, honey. She was over the edge most of the time. And he would have told you she's the reason he left, that anyone who had to live with that wench would drink too. Well, you know, I knew she was crazy. I just knew she was crazy. Like one night, one morning she came home. Should have come home the night before, didn't come home. Do you see the pattern in my life? She came home one Saturday morning and she said, Mom, it was terrible last night. We're driving down the freeway. We're minding our own business. We're not bothering anybody. Really, Mom, we weren't. And this car came from out of nowhere and it tried to run us off the road, Mom. It was really, really scary. And the police came and they said it wasn't our fault or anything, Mom. It was just really, really scary. And of course, by then I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Are you okay? Is everybody okay? Yes, Mom, we're all okay. I'm just a little tired. I think I'll go to my room. You know what she does? And I'm in the living room going, because I've done what I do best, which is soak up all the extra feelings laying around, you know, or I perceive them as extra feelings, and that's what I've done. I knew she was crazy. Well, 2 years after he moved out, school called, and they said, there's something the matter with your daughter. Duh. And they said, we're going to send her for an evaluation. Really? 2 days later, the guy at the treatment center says, oh, Miss Davis, really hate to tell you this, but we do believe your daughter's an alcoholic. And I went, yes. And he said, we've not had a lot of mothers react like that. And I'm like, yeehaw, alcoholism, okay. I thought she was just crazy. That's an Al-Anon disease. No signs you'll ever get any help for that. But alcoholism, yes, 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 yes. And she's 17, I can make her do stuff, you know. And I took her to a place that force-fed the steps into her because I knew it was the only thing that would work. Statistics are that 80% of the young people who come in today have to go back out because they're not finished. I am ever so grateful. I am ever so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous that they didn't treat my daughter like she was too young when she came in, that she hadn't suffered enough when she was out there, that because she did drugs, it somehow negated her alcoholism. The fact is my daughter got sober before it was ever legal for her to drink. It was easier for her to get drugs than it was alcohol. And my daughter was one of the ones who had to go back out. She stayed sober about a year and a half the first time, and she went back out. And one night she called and said, I have to have $300 by the morning or else. And I had to tell her I didn't have $300 to give her by the morning. She moved out of state. She said, I'm not sure if it's me or Dallas. So she moved. I went a long time. I went maybe a year without knowing where she was or what was going on with her. And January 29th of 1990, my daughter walked back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had nothing to do with it, and AA had everything to do with it. The best thing I ever did for my daughter was get a program and get a life and get out of her way and let her do what she needed to do. She has 14 years of continuous sobriety, which is just awesome to me. And it, you know, it's AA's miracle. It is not mine. I have to tell you this thing really quick. My daughter is in a group that's just been formed for 4 years, and then she's a very active member of her AA group, and it happens to be, for whatever reason, a group that doesn't particularly approve of Al-Anon. I will tell you that one of my daughter's deals in her sobriety is she doesn't want to be my daughter in a sobriety. And I understand that. She needs her own program with her own people without, oh, that's Ellen's daughter stuff going on. And I respect that in her. Boy, I'm just, you know, whatever works for her is okay by me. Well, she's been telling them from the get-go, you sure you don't want an Al-Anon speaker? I think I know where I can get one, blah, 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 you know. And they're like, no, we really don't need one. Well, this year they let Melissa and her friend Kelly be in charge of their four-year anniversary. Melissa said, do you all want to vote on the speakers? They said, no, you decide. Melissa said, they'll be having an Al-Anon speaker. I want you to know I had to leave my husband at the emergency room to go out there and do that. I told him I'd be back. I knew he wasn't going anywhere, you know. Not much I can do in the emergency room anyway, you know, anymore. I used to think I was a big help in there. I'm really not. You know, I'm really pretty much just take up space in there. They know what they're doing. We've been in an emergency room before, no big deal. I mean, one big deal for me was probably a bigger deal for my husband, but I told him I'd be back, and sure enough, you know, I went out there and did my talk, came back. He was still in the emergency room. He hadn't gone anywhere. And so anyway, I went out and did this talk, and I knew because, you know, I just knew. You know how that is? I just knew that there'd be me and Melissa and Kelly, you know, her friend. That would be pretty much us there for my talk, and that was okay with me. Whoever of you is here is whoever's supposed to be here, and that's not up to me, so what do I care? I don't care. And sure enough, up until about 5 minutes before I was supposed to talk, it was pretty much me and Kelly and Melissa. And it wasn't pretty much, it was me and Kelly and Melissa. And by the time I started talking, there was about 30 people in there, and Melissa had broken her own anonymity and introduced me as her mother, which was a big deal, baby. It was a big deal. Afterwards, this little gal came up to me, and she said, my name is blah, 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 whatever it was. And she said, I've called you and talked to you on the phone before. And I said, oh, and you're an Al-Anon, right? She said, yes. And I said, you know, I didn't think there were any Al-Anons in here. I thought they were just A's. She looked around the room, and she said, yeah, there's some Al-Anons in here. I'm not kidding. It was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And none of them identified themselves to me. Whoever they were, they just went on their way. They just like snuck on out of there. Let's wonder why they haven't had an Al-Anon meeting. I don't know. I got a call from this little gal about 10 days ago. And I did this about 3 weeks ago, maybe. About 10 days ago, I got a call from this gal. She said, we're having our first Al-Anon meeting next week. Would you come chair our first meeting? I said, can't come to your first one. Got to have a massage that night. I'll come the second night. Would you come? They're having an Al-Anon meeting. And my daughter was instrumental in getting that meeting started, you know. It's bizarre how that stuff works. Just bizarre how that works. Anyway, in that little time that my daughter was sober, she started hanging out with slippery places and slippery people. And I said to her for the umpteenth time, if you can't do by the rules in this house, you can't stay here. And, of course, she couldn't. And for the first time, I knew that what it felt like was if she drinks, I'll die. And I knew that it was up to me, that no one else was going to give me peace of mind. It was up to me to find my own peace of mind. And I made the decision that she had a certain date she had to get stuff done by, and of course she didn't. And I planned that date to be the week that I was, you're getting ready to wave at me, Terry. I was getting ready to go to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends, because I had to go to intensive care. I didn't want to kick my daughter out, you know. I didn't. I wanted her healthy and home and happy, and she was none of those things. And the morning I was kicking her out, she threw herself on my bed and said, you're going to be a grandma. And I thought that changed everything. I'd have to stay home and be the responsible party. What I found out in that exchange by calling my sponsor was that my sponsor said, she doesn't have to stay if you don't want her to, and I'll stay on the phone while you tell her. And I put the phone down on the bed. I can see it today. And my sponsor was in the room with me via the phone while I told her she couldn't stay. And I quit hurting. I thought the pain was about letting her go, but the pain was about holding on when it was time to let her go, and it was time to let her go. And we went through a fall where she went around telling everybody how mean I was. She was pregnant, and I wouldn't let her be at home. And I went around telling everybody what she was doing to me now. I told my friend Buddy Ross, who was taping a conference, I said, Buddy, she's pregnant at me now. But he said, you know, he said, man, I understand. He said, our son's girlfriend got pregnant out of wedlock. And he said, you know what? That baby has been the light of our lives. It never occurred to me I might like it. I was doing the yeah, but thing. Yeah, but that's not right, God. Not this child. She's too young. Not me. I'm too young. We can't do this. Neither one of us is responsible. I don't know why you're thinking this baby's a good idea. God, it's obviously not a good idea. Al-Anon has allowed me to change my mind. I've loved babies my whole life. We've been blessed to have a darling little girl in here today who's just been an angel for somebody who never got a nap all day long. I thought she was awfully good. And God was giving me another one of those blessings, and I'm saying, yeah, but, you know. And I decided to say thank you. I decided that I would say thank you to this baby and that I would be the grandmother for this baby. So Melissa called me a couple of months after. Mom, blue blanket you're knitting, knit faster. Had a sonogram today. Twin boys. Oh, yeah. If one is good, just think what two will do. The fact is, if there'd only been one of them, you'd probably have a different speaker. But there were two of them. I look at that second boy today, and I think, you have made such a change in my life, little boy. That's another long story, but suffice it to say that when they were 3 weeks old, one of them went into heart failure, and we got him to the hospital. Melissa didn't know what to do. It was way over her head to figure out what to do. And when they were 5 weeks old, she said, I can't keep them, and you can have them if you want them. And I had to hang my life one more time on my sponsor's word. She'd been telling me for a long time that God wants for me what I want for me in my heart of hearts. But I have that Al-Anon problem with making a decision. What if I decide the wrong thing? What if there's something better and I can't think of it just yet? I don't want to make a commitment. We look like we're so committed. We're not committed. Our bags are packed all the time, you know. We are out of here in a heartbeat. If this isn't going my way, my feet might stay here, but the rest of me is gone, you know. This window closed. We were talking about that today. Whoop, this window closed, and I'm out of here, man. She said, you're not responsible for where you get to. That's God's deal. You're only responsible for the footwork. You walk in the direction of your dreams. And where you get is God's deal, and God's promise is this or something better. God is not here to torture you. He is not a terrorist waiting around the corner to test your patience, you know. God is here to give you everything you can dream of and more. So I walked in the direction of my dreams. I wanted to be their grandmother, but I didn't want to be their parents. My daughter moved out. We thought it'd take a couple of weeks. It took several months, and somehow my son and I, with a baby with heart problems and me with a full-time job and him in summer school, and somehow we managed those babies for almost 5 months. And then the day came when Lutheran Services said, we know the people you're talking about. They don't care that they're two babies. Because, see, I went to adoption agencies, and I said, I'm looking for a family that wants two babies and a grandmother. We're coming as a package. And Lutheran Services said, we know who you're talking about. They don't care that they're two babies. They don't care that one of them's got some physical issues. They don't care that the family wants to stay involved. What they said was, if it's God's will. And my daughter said, I pick them. I said, boy, me too. My boys will be 16, God in heaven, 16 years old this March the 15th. There's not been a month of their lives they haven't seen me. I have at least a meal with them every month. I'm their grandmother. I've always been their grandmother. They were about 10 before they started to realize that we really had a very strange family tree. It was more like a vine than a tree. And actually, their grandmother's younger than their mother. And how did that happen? And whose parent am I, by the way, you know? It had never occurred to them that they're boys. You know what I mean? Clueless. Just clueless. You know, it's just the way it is. Till they're about 10. And then one day they went, you know, like, this is really weird. Does anybody know? Really weird. He's waving. Okay, tear the countdown. So, suffice it to say. By the time the boys left, I decided to quit dating. I discovered since I was 12, I was either chasing after, going with, engaged to, married to, divorced from, engaged to, married to, divorced from, but there'd always been somebody. I walk with the hole beside me, and I'd like to tell you there were very special people I threw in that hole. I don't even remember their names, most of them. I'm just filling up the hole, which I couldn't do. And I decided I could never find myself as long as I was in a relationship with somebody. If you don't date boys, pretty much leaves you girls. Don't like girls, never did. Girls do girly stuff. I am not a girly girl. Girls like to go shopping. Ugh, I shop like a man. If you don't know what you want, don't go in there. If you know what you want, go get it, get out. Don't hang around. If you got something to say when you call me, say it. Otherwise, hang up the flipping phone. You know, I'm busy. I got stuff to do. I made a discovery, though, in the time. I always say it was years. I actually think it was just like a year. But I always say, in the years I hung out with the women, that God, I always wanted God to speak to me in thunder and lightning. A little drama is my life. And God really only speaks to me in the language I understand. You know, God says, Ellen, if I did that one more time, you'd miss the message and get lost in the messenger, you know. God speaks to me in the language I understand, and that's another woman. And in that time that I spent with just girls, not looking for a hymn, I discovered that I'm enough for me. that nobody has to be added to make me okay. I'm okay. Someone comes along, great. If not, great. Someone came along, big surprise, eh? Known him a long time, didn't match the list, asked me to dinner, no harm, went to dinner. We're married. Everybody said, oh my God, you've married a normal guy. He is 80 pounds overweight. This is not a normal guy. He's got an obsession. That's all I need. I need a guy with an obsession. It's very obvious what his is. Nobody has to point fingers, you know. We know what it is. There it is. Whew, thank you, God. I can work on my trophy, you know, a little while longer. Actually, and then in 1994, he stood up at an AA meeting, because if you're going to hang out with me, he's going to hang out with you. And so he'd gone to a lot of AA meetings, you know, and he stood up at an AA meeting and said he was an alcoholic and got a chip and had a drink since then. And my girlfriend behind me, everybody's crying and carrying on because they all know him, you know, and she's slapping me on the back and she said, oh my God, you're a carrier. The end, coming up here. The big wind-up. I told you today what I've done the last few years of my life. I'm going to tell you how I got to do that. My kids asked me to quit my job of 20 years and stay home and take care of their children, which I thought was an awesome thing for the people who had borne the brunt of my disease, that they wanted me to stay home and take care of their kids. My husband said, you can't. We need your money. He makes 10 times the money I ever made, but mine was important. A little financial insecurity there. Okay, fine. Then he heard a tape. When he heard an AA speaker say that someone had asked him once how much money he'd have to have so he didn't feel financial insecurity, and he said, I guess just enough so I wouldn't trust God. Wouldn't have to trust God. And the minute he heard that, he went, oh, you can stay home if you want to. So I run a little business called Moms Better Babies, affordable daycare for your priceless children, but the only children I'll take are my grandchildren, don't ask me. I'm really good at this, and a lot of people have asked, but I'm not taking. And it doesn't make any money. It's a pretty poor business, actually, all in all, but it's the best job I ever had. They pay me to sleep with the people I work with. What kind of fabulous job is that, you know? It's the one I always wanted. Anyway, I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, let's pull out the VCR and the tape, and I want to see how her husband and her children turned out, and if they turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, she's earned her way into heaven, and she can come in. I'm so glad you've given me the chance to find another God. It's another one of those stories I make up in my head because I don't know exactly what's going on, but my sponsor said this was one of the stories I could keep. I suspect that when this little body of mine gets tired of doing whatever in the world it is we're doing here, you should pardon the pun, and the part of me that's always been God's goes to wherever it is God is, that when I get there, God's going to go, oh, Ellen, there you are. Why would God greet me with less love than you do? And he's going to say, baby, you know what? Heaven is heaven when you're not here, but it's just not perfect without you. Sit right here beside me. And he's going to say, honey, I've been running a little experiment down there. Not a test. Nothing you could pass or fail. It's just an experiment. I thought it'd be kind of interesting. And I know you've been paying close attention to what's going on, so I'd like to know how it's going. Let me ask you a couple of questions. Number one, did you have a good time? You know, I didn't do a single thing to torment you. There's no reason for flowers to be different colors, except I thought it'd make you smile. And I knew you'd love babies, so I put a lot of them in your life, and I hope you didn't miss them. And thanks to you, I'm going to be able to say, oh, yes, God, I had a great time at your party. Thanks for asking me. And then he's going to say, were you Ellen? You know, you're the only one like that I made. And I made you to do things for me that I can't do because my hands are too big. I spent a couple of years in my 11-step inventory at night writing down today, Ellen, writing down the thing I did that day that I knew was mine to do because I've spent so much of my life doing your things. And I needed to know that I was doing my things. This day was mine to do. You could have had another speaker been home by now. That's not the way it worked. You had me. This was mine to do. And when I looked at that after however long I did it in my inventory, I realized that the things that you would call those service work is what were mine to do. And the last thing he's going to say is, baby, did you ever get the joke? I know today I've spent so much of my life looking at the hole and not the donut. I spent so much of my life focusing on the part of the glass I thought was empty. There's a guy in our group that says the glass isn't half full or half empty. Glass is too damn big. Bill Cosby says a glass is either half full or half empty, depending on whether you're drinking or pouring. What you allow me to do when you listen to my story, as you have tonight, is you've allowed me to pour. And so when I leave here, my cup will runneth over, and I thank you.